Chapter 15. It's not about the money. In 2004, a man named Joel John Roberts published a plaintive book called How to Increase Homelessness. In it, he pointed out that, for more than 30 years, a large and financially motivated lobby of homeless service providers, homeless housing developers, labor unions, for-profit consultants, and advocacy groups have lobbied at the federal, state, and local level to increase funding for themselves. During that time, homelessness only grew worse. I do not know of any community plan that actually details how to dismantle the existing homeless service system after homelessness has ended, wrote Roberts. Maybe, just maybe, we don't really want to end homelessness. One might be tempted to dismiss Roberts' book as yet another diatribe against the homeless industrial complex, were it not for the fact that he is an important figure within it. Roberts is CEO of PATH, an integrated housing and services homelessness agency in Los Angeles. He was chairperson of the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority Advisory Board and a member of LA's Blue Ribbon Panel on Homelessness. Roberts was saying something similar to HBO's Bill Maher, who described the homeless industrial complex as layer upon layer of middlemen, inspectors, contractors, lawyers, lobbyists, and, oh yes, labor unions too. And until those $531,000 apartments are built, we are putting special porta potties near the homeless camps, which cost $320,000 each for porta potties. That's some good shit. The amounts of money are not small. California spent at least $13 billion on homelessness between 2018 and 2020. San Francisco alone will spend $672 million on homelessness in the 2021-22 fiscal year. As of spring 2021, the homeless industrial complex was gearing up to seek more money from California taxpayers through legislation that would increase taxes on businesses with more than $5 million in annual revenue and raise over $2 billion more. The nonprofit service organizations funded by taxpayers turn around and advocate for taxpayer funding, a conflict of interest. The beautiful thing about the way we have it set up, said Kristen Marshall, who runs San Francisco's overdose prevention program, is that drug overdose prevention nonprofit, DOPE, is funded by the Department of Public Health. But we're a program of Human Rights Coalition, so we're not a city agency. We're independent. And that's what gives us the leverage to fight and work the way we do. If we worked in the city system, we wouldn't get anything done. We are putting in place restrictions on evictions, reparations for Black San Francisco, and showing up every single place and every single time our people are being discussed. And yet, most influential homelessness advocacy organizations are not service providers and have small budgets. The annual revenues of Jennifer Friedenbach's Coalition on Homelessness, the most influential homelessness advocacy organization in San Francisco, were just $656,892, according to its most recently available tax filing. To put that number in context, consider that the annual revenues of the Nature Conservancy and the National Rifle Association were $1.2 billion and $353 million, respectively, in 2018. As such, advocates for the homeless would not be so successful in passing ballot measures, raising taxes, and increasing funding for homelessness programs if voters didn't support spending more money on the problem. If voters thought the homelessness industrial complex was causing more harm than good, enabling addiction and overdoses, for example, rather than preventing them, they would not have voted to keep giving them more money over the past 30 years. The problem, in other words, isn't coming from within the homeless industrial complex. It's coming from within ourselves. Progressive homelessness advocates hold two moral values particularly deeply: caring and fairness. Across many scales, surveys, and political controversies, notes the psychologist Jonathan Haidt, liberals turn out to be more disturbed by signs of violence and suffering compared to conservatives, and especially to libertarians. But in the process of valuing care so much, progressives abandoned other important values, argue Haidt and other researchers in a field called moral foundations theory. Researchers point to surveys of over 11,000 people over the last 20 years to suggest the existence of six universal values: caring, fairness, liberty, sanctity, authority, and loyalty. Haidt and others note that while progressives, liberal and very liberal people, hold the values of caring, fairness, and liberty, they tend to reject sanctity, authority, and loyalty as wrong. Because these values are so deeply held, often subconsciously, moral foundations theory explains well why so many progressives and conservatives today view each other as not merely uninformed but immoral. The values of sanctity and authority appear to explain why conservatives and moderate Democrats, more than progressives, favor prohibitions on things like sleeping on sidewalks, public use of hard drugs, and other behaviors. In a more traditional morality, drug use is seen as violating the sanctity of the body and the importance of self-control. Sleeping on sidewalks is seen as violating the value of authority of laws and thus loyalty to America. Writes Haidt, liberals are often willing to trade away fairness when it conflicts with compassion or their desire to fight oppression. But there is a twist. Progressives don't trade away fairness for victims, only for those they see as privileged. Progressives still value fairness, but more for victims, and their progressive allies, than for everyone equally, and particularly not for people progressives view as the oppressors and victimizers. Conservatives and moderates tend to define fairness around equal treatment, including enforcement of the law. They tend to believe we should enforce the law against the homeless man who is sleeping and urinating on BART even if he is a victim. Progressives disagree. They demand we take into account that the man is a victim in deciding whether to arrest and how to sentence whole classes of people, including the homeless, mentally ill, and addicts. Progressives also value liberty or freedom differently from conservatives. Many progressives reject the value of liberty for big tobacco and cigarette smokers, but embrace the value of liberty for fentanyl dealers and users. Why? Because progressives view fentanyl dealers and users who are disproportionately poor, sick, and non-white as victims of a bad system and big tobacco as part of it. Progressives also value authority and loyalty for victims above everyone else. San Francisco homelessness advocate Jennifer Friedenbach told me that we should center unhoused people, primarily black and brown folks, that are experiencing homelessness, folks with disabilities. They're the voices that should be centered. She is not rejecting authority or loyalty. Rather, she is suggesting that we should have loyalty to the victims, and that they, not governments, should have authority. Indeed, progressives insist on taking orders, supposedly without questioning them, from the homeless themselves. Drug use is often the only thing that feels good for them, to oversimplify it, said Kristen Marshall. When you understand that, you stop caring about the drug use and ask people what they need. The San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness has similarly argued that the city must let homeless people sit and lie on sidewalks and camp in public spaces, including parks and sidewalks, if that's what they would prefer, rather than require them to stay in shelters. Once you decide in advance to let victims determine their fates, then much else can be justified. Many progressives do something similar with sanctity, which is to value some things as sacred or pure. When Monique Tula, the head of the Harm Reduction Coalition, insisted on bodily autonomy against mandatory drug treatment for people who break the law to support their addiction, she was insisting upon the sanctity of the body, not rejecting it. The difference between her definition of sanctity and the traditional view of sanctity was what violated it. Where traditional morality views recreational injection drug use as a violation of the sanctity of the body, Tula, like many libertarians, believes that the state coercing sobriety is. The germ of the idea that society should be organized around the downtrodden was developed by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels in the mid-19th century. In the Communist Manifesto, they argued that it was possible and desirable to build a radically egalitarian society. We would do so from a place of cooperation, not competition. Socialism would take us from our current system of capitalist meritocracy to communist utopia. While Marx and Engels described the worker overthrow of the government in economic and social terms, revolution had a spiritual meaning too, the total redemption of humanity. Marx and Engels thought factory workers, the proletariat, were the people who would make the revolution. They believed that labor, not capital, was the source of economic value. The only way for capitalists to make money was to underpay those who created value for them. Capitalists, mean or nice, had no choice but to do so, in order to compete in the system. While Marx and Engels believed that unemployed, disaffiliated, and often homeless people, whom they called the lumpen proletariat, would benefit from life under communism, the lumpen proletariat had no special role in creating the revolution, because their exploitation wasn't necessary for capitalism's success. In the early and mid-20th century, socialists and radical thinkers and activists began to realize that the proletariat was too disorganized and weak to achieve revolution. They sought to build a much broader political coalition. In California, the International Workers of the World, an anarchist group founded in 1905, sought to link the economic interests of the working class with those of the homeless, the people Marx and Engels had dismissed as the lumpen proletariat. They blamed the government and capitalism for their fate. They recruited hobos, who illegally hitched rides on railroad cars, and migrant farm workers as members. Antonio Gramsci, head of the Italian Communist Party in the 1930s, realized after being imprisoned by Benito Mussolini that fascists had defeated communists because they had taken over important cultural institutions, like the church, schools, and the military. If communists wanted to have the same influence, Gramsci reasoned, they would need to do the same. By the mid-20th century, many radicals had grown disillusioned with the Communist Party as they watched the moral failures and bureaucratic stagnation of the Soviet Union. In the United States, the trade unions, which were once a bastion of the left, had become fiercely anti-communist and patriotic, notes a political historian. In the 1950s, the Marxist American sociologist, C. Wright Mills, argued that students could be a more revolutionary class than workers, which inspired young baby boomers who infused the radical, anti-modern, an anti-Enlightenment new left. In the 1960s, some progressives came to believe that Black Americans were inherently revolutionary due to their disadvantaged position in society, and that white people could join the revolution by following their lead. The loosening of traditional morality widened the possibilities available to many people, but it also created a moral and spiritual vacuum. Where major religions had viewed humans as having souls that had some continued existence after the death of the body, the new secularism tended toward the view that consciousness was the result of material processes. Humans had no spirit independent of the biological processes inside the physical brain. Once we died, nothing in us lived on. Such hard secularism created anxiety. Whereas people on the political right tend to adhere more closely to traditional religions and moralities, whether Christianity, Judaism, or Hinduism, progressives are more secular, atheist, agnostic, and more open to alternative religions. Research suggests that progressives are more existentially anxious, neurotic, and unhappy, which some researchers attribute to lower levels of religiosity. One of the long-recognized benefits of religion is that it helps people to cope with their fear of death. If we follow a certain code of conduct or morality, religions around the globe say, we can transcend death and live on in a new world, whether heaven or a future world, through reincarnation. Friedrich Nietzsche, in the late 19th century, predicted that rising disbelief in God and life after death would result in new moralities and religions. Some would try to turn science into a religion, he believed, which is today known as scientism. The two great political religions of the 20th century were fascism and communism. Where Christians believed that the kingdom of God is in heaven, communists believed the kingdom of communism was in the future. And where Christians had believed in the ultimate authority of God, fascists believed in the authority of the state as the manifestation of the spirit of the nation or race. As these two great ideologies lost legitimacy and power in the 20th century, they split and changed into different moralities and ideologies. In the Marxist story, workers had played the role of hero, overcoming all odds to save the world. They started as mere peasants on a farm before moving to the city and being exploited in the factories. Over time, they and their children learned to read and demanded their rights from the bosses. They organized unions and valued loyalty to those who were in their same socioeconomic class. They came to understand their exploitation and their special role in history, which Marx believed they were destined to play for inherent structural reasons. Similar to enslaved people who revolted, factory workers would one day rise up, take control of the factories, and take control of governments, violently or nonviolently. The workers would embrace technological progress and share its rewards in the form of material wealth and leisure time. Starting in the 1960s, many on the New Left cast African American prisoners in the role of revolutionary and even spiritual heroes. For some New Left extremists, noted a historian, radical black prisoners had become nature spirits, self-actualized, noble, violent, sexual primitives. Said a white attorney for radical prisoners, they are more loving. They have more creative human potential, wrote the white left-wing editor of radical prisoner George Jackson's books in 1974. For most middle-class whites like myself, life is a matter of chronic discontent. We say to ourselves that only blacks possess true authenticity. The white attorney's office in Berkeley had massive posters of the black prison leaders on the walls and a staff of young white women, noted a sociologist at the time. All of them had picked one of them as the one that she was worshiping. All religions and moralities have light and dark sides, suggests Haight. Morality binds and blinds, he writes. On the one hand, they bind us together in groups and societies, helping us realize our individual and social needs, and are thus very positive. But religions and moralities can also create giant blind spots, preventing us from seeing our dark sides, and thus can be very negative. The dark side of victimology is how it moralizes power. Victimology takes the truth that it is wrong for people to be victimized and distorts it by going a step further. Victimology asserts that victims are inherently good because they have been victimized. It robs victims of their moral agency and creates double standards that frustrate any attempt to criticize their behavior, even if they're behaving in self-destructive, antisocial ways, like smoking fentanyl and living in a tent on the sidewalk. Such reasoning is obviously faulty. It purifies victims of all badness, and it insists that pure victim goodness can only result in more good things, never bad ones. Such a view is obviously wrong, but by appealing to emotion, victimology overrides reason and logic. This is not a phenomenon of ignorant people, but rather of highly educated ones. It was philosophers, university professors, and journalists after World War II who decided that because the mentally ill had been so badly mistreated, they needed to be freed immediately, even though that meant becoming homeless and often incarcerated. The same kinds of people in the 1990s felt that because America had gone overboard with drug prohibition, punishment, and mass incarceration, we should not pressure addicts as they do in Portugal and the Netherlands to get sober. And it is educated progressives in West Coast cities today who point to centuries of racism as reason for stopping enforcing the laws that make city life possible, including laws against armed gangs taking over whole neighborhoods. Charity, and acting from altruism more broadly, has long had a dark side. Consider St. Francis. He was born rich, the son of a prosperous silk trader. After he heard the voice of Jesus say, "Go, Francis, and repair my house, which, as you see, is falling into ruin," Francis went home and stole from his father both money and valuable silk cloth. After the priest at the local church rejected his offering, Francis grew angry and made a scene, suggesting that his act was selfishly motivated. Francis is an extreme character, but also a familiar one. Psychological research supports what might seem intuitively obvious, which is that many people behave in more altruistic, generous, and compassionate ways when they know they are being watched. There is nothing necessarily wrong with conspicuous compassion. Philanthropists who have sought to win the altruism game have achieved many positive things, including higher agricultural yields, the elimination of disease, and rights for traditionally victimized minorities. And when they accomplish positive things, they deserve recognition. The problem is when compassion acts as cover for darker motivations. Throughout history, people who appear to have the dark triad personality traits of psychopathy, Machiavellianism, and narcissism, most famously Stalin and Mao, have successfully manipulated compassionate, idealistic people to support them, even after evidence of their barbarism came to light. What is notable is that they have often done so not by pretending to be altruistic, but by being genuinely altruistic. If we are to understand why progressives ruin cities, we need to understand how and why compassion, altruism, and love have created a blind spot, and not just in relationship to foreign despots, but also to homegrown ones.